You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to the CEU Lectures. I'm John Shattuck, President and Rector of Central European University. It's my great privilege to introduce this special series of five lectures by George Soros held here in Budapest at the Hungarian Academy of Sciences under the auspices of Central European University. In these lectures, George Soros will draw upon a lifetime of practical and philosophical reflection and share his latest thinking on economics and politics. Today, Mr. Soros will present the fundamentals of his philosophical theory. Each lecture will be video conferenced to one of five universities on four continents, creating an unprecedented, interactive, international audience of students in real time. Today's lecture will include students from the London School of Economics, in addition to the invited guests and Central European University students who are here at the Academy. Our moderator today is the distinguished philosopher Colin McGinn, renowned for his work in the philosophy of mind. Mr. Soros will lecture for approximately 50 minutes, and Mr. McGinn will offer a brief response. Mr. Soros will then take questions from the audience, starting with three questions from the London School of Economics, and then from our audience here in Budapest. I'm now delighted to present George Soros, who truly needs no introduction.
Thank you very much, and thank you for all for coming, and both here and in London. In the course of my life, I've developed a conceptual framework which has helped me both in making money as a hedge fund manager and in spending it as a policy-oriented philanthropist. But the framework itself is not about money. It's about the relationship between thinking and reality, a subject that is extensively studied by philosophers from early on. I started developing my philosophy as a student at the London School of Economics in the late 1950s. I took my final exams 1 year early, and I had a year to fill before I was qualified to receive my degree. I could choose my own tutor, and I chose Karl Popper, whose book, The Open Society and Its Enemies, had made a profound impression on me. In his books, Popper argued that the empirical truth can't be known with absolute certainty. Even scientific laws can't be verified beyond the shadow of a doubt. They can only be falsified by testing. One failed test is enough to falsify, but no amount of confirming instances is sufficient to verify. Scientific laws are hypothetical in character, and their truth remains subject to testing. Ideologies, which claim to be in possession of the ultimate truth, are making a false claim. Therefore, they can be imposed on society only by force. This applies to communism, fascism, and national socialism alike. All these ideologies lead to repression. Popper proposed a more attractive form of social organization, an open society in which people are free to hold divergent opinions, and the rule of law allows people with different views and different interests to live together in peace. Having lived through both Nazi and communist occupation here in Hungary, I found the idea of an open society immensely attractive. While I was reading Popper, I was also studying economic theory, and I was struck by the contradiction between Popper's emphasis on imperfect understanding and the theory of perfect competition in economics, which postulated perfect knowledge. This led me to start questioning the assumptions of economic theory. These were the two major theoretical inspirations of my philosophy. It's also deeply rooted in my personal history. The formative experience of my life was the German occupation of Hungary in 1944. I was not yet 14 years old at the time, coming from a reasonably well-to-do middle-class background, suddenly confronted with the prospect of being deported and killed just because I was Jewish. Fortunately, my father was well prepared for this far from equilibrium experience. He had lived through the Russian Revolution, and that was the formative experience of his life. Until then, he had been an ambitious young man. When the First World War broke out, he volunteered to serve in the Austro-Hungarian army. He was captured by the Russians and taken as a prisoner of war to Siberia. Being ambitious, he became the editor of a newspaper produced by the prisoners. It was handwritten and displayed on a plank, and it was called The Plank. This made him so popular that he was elected the prisoner's representative. Then some soldiers escaped from a neighboring camp, and their prisoner's representative was shot in retaliation. My father, instead of waiting for the same thing to happen in his camp, organized a breakout. His plan was to build a raft and sail down to the ocean. But his knowledge of geography was somewhat deficient. He didn't realize that all the rivers in Siberia flow into the Arctic. They drifted for several weeks before they realized that they were heading for the Arctic. And it took them several more months to make their way back to civilization across the taiga. In the meantime, the Russian Revolution broke out, and they became caught up in it. Only after a variety of adventures did my father manage to find his way back to Hungary. Had he remained in the camp, he would have arrived home much sooner. My father came home a changed man. His experiences during the Russian Revolution profoundly affected him. He lost his ambition and wanted nothing more from life than to enjoy it. He imparted to his children values that were very different from those of the milieu in which we lived. He had no desire to amass wealth or become socially prominent. On the contrary, he worked only as much as was necessary to make ends meet. I remember being sent to his main client to borrow some money before we went on a skiing holiday. My father was grouchy for months afterwards because he had to work to pay it back. Although we were reasonably prosperous, we were not the typical bourgeois family, and we were proud of being different. In 1944, when the Germans occupied Hungary, my father immediately realized that these were not normal times and the normal rules didn't apply. He arranged false identities for his family and a number of other people. Those who could paid. Others he helped for free. Most of them survived. That was his finest hour. Living with false identity turned out to be an exhilarating experience for me too. We were in mortal danger. People perished all around us, but we managed not only to survive, but to help other people. We were on the side of the angels, and we triumphed against overwhelming odds. This made me feel very special. It was high adventure. I had a reliable guide in my father and came through unscathed. What more could a 14-year-old ask for? after the euphoric experience of escaping the Nazis, life in Hungary started to lose its luster during the Soviet occupation. I was looking for new challenges, and with the help of my father, I found my way out of Hungary. When I was 17, I became a student in London. In my studies, my primary interest was to gain a better understanding of the strange world into which I had been born. But I have to confess, I also harbored some fantasies of becoming an important philosopher. I believed that I had gained insights that set me apart from other people. Living in London was a big letdown. I was without money, alone, and people were not interested in what I had to say. But I didn't abandon my philosophical ambitions, even when circumstances forced me to make a living in more mundane pursuits. After completing my studies, I had a number of false starts. Finally, I ended up as an arbitrage trader in New York. But in my free time, I continued to work on my philosophy. That's how I came to write my first major essay, entitled The Burden of Consciousness. It was an attempt to model a Popper's framework of open and closed societies. It linked organic society with a traditional mode of thinking, closed society with a dogmatic mode, and open society with a critical mode. What I could not properly resolve was the nature of the relationship between the mode of thinking and the actual state of affairs. That problem continued to preoccupy me, and that's how I came to develop the concept of reflexivity, a concept I shall explore in greater detail a little later. It so happened that the concept of reflexivity provided me with a new way of looking at financial markets, a better way than the prevailing theory. This gave me an edge, first as a securities analyst and then as a hedge fund manager. I felt as if I were in possession of a major discovery that would enable me to fulfill my fantasy of becoming an important philosopher. At a certain moment when my business career ran into a roadblock, I shifted gears and devoted all my energies to developing my theory. But I treasured my discovery so much that I couldn't part with it. I felt that the concept of reflexivity needed to be explored in great depth. As I delved deeper and deeper into the subject, I got lost in the intricacies of my own constructions. One morning, I couldn't understand what I had written the night before. At that point, I decided to abandon my philosophical explorations and to focus on making money. It was only many years later, after a successful run as a hedge fund manager, that I returned to my philosophy. I published my first essay, The Alchemy of Finance, in 1987. In that book, I tried to explain the philosophical underpinnings of my approach to financial markets. The book attracted a certain amount of attention. It has been read by most people in the hedge fund industry, and it is taught in business schools. But the philosophical arguments didn't make much of an impression. They were largely dismissed as the conceit of a man who has been successful in business and fancied himself as a philosopher. I myself came to doubt whether I was in possession of a major new insight. After all, I was dealing with a subject that has been explored by philosophers since time immemorial. What grounds did I have for thinking that I had made a new discovery, especially as nobody else seems to think so? Undoubtedly, the conceptual framework was useful to me personally, but it didn't seem to be considered equally valuable by others. I had to accept that judgment. I didn't give up my philosophical interests, but I came to regard them as a personal predilection. I continued to be guided by my conceptual framework, both in my business and in my philanthropic activities, which came to assume an increasingly important role in my life. And each time I wrote a book, I faithfully recited my arguments. This helped me to develop my conceptual framework, but I continued to consider myself a failed philosopher. Once I even gave a lecture with the title, "A Failed Philosopher Tries Again." All this has changed as a result of the financial crisis of 2008. My conceptual framework enabled me both to anticipate the crisis and to deal with it when it finally struck. It has also enabled me to explain and predict events better than most others. This has changed my own evaluation and that of many others. My philosophy is no longer a personal matter. It deserves to be taken seriously as a possible contribution to our understanding of reality. And that is what has prompted me to give this series of lectures. So here it goes. Today, I shall explain the concept of fallibility and reflexivity in general terms. Tomorrow, I shall apply them to the financial markets, and after that, to politics. That will also bring in the concept of open society. In the fourth lecture, I shall explore the difference between market values and moral values. And in the fifth, I shall give some predictions and prescriptions for the present moment in history. I can state the core idea in two relatively simple propositions. One is that the situation that has thinking participants, the participants' view of the world is always partial and distorted. That's the principle of fallibility. The other is that these distorted views can influence the situation to which they relate because false views lead to inappropriate actions. That's the principle of reflexivity. For instance, treating drug addicts as criminals creates criminal behavior. It misconstrues the problem and interferes with the proper treatment of addicts. As another example, declaring that government is bad tends to make for bad government. Both fallibility and reflexivity are sheer common sense. So when my critics say that I am merely stating the obvious, they are right, up to a point. What makes my propositions interesting is that their significance has not been generally appreciated. The concept of reflexivity in particular has been studiously avoided and even denied by economic theory. So my conceptual framework deserves to be taken seriously, not because it constitutes a new discovery, but because something as commonsensical as reflexivity has been so studiously ignored. Recognizing reflexivity has been sacrificed to the vain pursuit of certainty in human affairs, most notably in economics. And yet, uncertainty is the key feature of human affairs. Economic theory is built on the concept of equilibrium. And that concept is in direct contradiction with the concept of reflexivity. As I shall try to show in the next lecture, the two concepts yield to two entirely different interpretations of financial markets. The concept of fallibility is far less controversial. It's generally recognized that the complexity of the world in which we live exceeds our capacity to comprehend it. I have no great new insights to offer. The main source of difficulty is that participants are part of the situation they have to deal with. Confronted by a reality of extreme complexity, we are obliged to resort to various methods of simplification, generalizations, dichotomies, metaphors, decision rules, moral precepts, to mention just a few. These mental constructs take on an existence of their own, further complicating the situation. The structure of the brain is another source of distortions. Recent advances in brain science have begun to provide some insight into how the brain functions, and they have substantiated Hume's contention that reason is the slave of passion. The idea of a disembodied intellect or reason is a figment of our imagination. The brain is bombarded by millions of sensory impulses, but consciousness can only process only 7 or 8 subjects concurrently. The impulses need to be condensed, ordered, and interpreted under immense time pressure, and mistakes and distortions can't be avoided. Brain science adds many new details to my original contention that our understanding of the world in which we live is inherently imperfect. The concept of reflexivity needs a little more explanation. It applies exclusively to situations that have thinking participants. The participants' thinking serves two functions. One is to understand the world in which we live. I call this the cognitive function. The other is to change the situation to our advantage. I call this the manipulating or participating function. The two functions connect thinking and reality in opposite directions. In the cognitive function, reality is supposed to determine the participants' views. The direction of causation is from the world to the mind. By contrast, in the manipulative function, the direction of causation is from the mind to the world. That is to say, the intentions of the participants have an effect on the world. When both functions operate at the same time, they can interfere with each other. How? By depriving each function of the independent variable that would be needed to determine the value of the dependent variable. Because when the independent variable of one function is the dependent variable of the other, neither function has a genuinely independent variable. This means that the cognitive function can't produce enough knowledge to serve as the basis of the participants' decisions. Similarly, the manipulative function can have an effect on the outcome, but can't determine it. In other words, the outcome is liable to diverge from the participants' intentions. There is bound to be some slippage between intentions and actions, and further slippage between actions and outcomes. As a result, there is an element of uncertainty both in our understanding of reality and in the actual course of events. To understand the uncertainties associated with reflexivity, we need to probe a little further. If the cognitive function operated in isolation, without any interference from the manipulative function, it could produce knowledge. Knowledge is represented by two statements. A statement is true if it corresponds to the facts. That's what the correspondence theory of truth tells us. But if there is interference from the manipulative function, the facts no longer serve as an independent criterion by which the truth of a statement can be judged, because the correspondence may have been brought about by the statement changing the facts. Consider the statement, it's raining. That statement is true or false, depending on whether it is, in fact, raining. Now consider the statement, this is a revolutionary moment. That statement is reflexive, and its truth value depends on the impact it makes. Reflexive statements have some affinity with the paradox of the liar, which is a self-referential statement. But while self-reference has been extensively analyzed, reflexivity has received much less attention. That's strange, because reflexivity has an impact on the real world, while self-reference is purely a linguistic phenomenon. In the real world, the participant's thinking finds expression not only in statements, but also in various forms of action and behavior. That makes reflexivity a very broad phenomenon that typically takes the form of feedback loops. The participant's views influence the course of events, and the course of events influences the participant's views. The influence is continuous and circular. That's what turns it into a feedback loop. Reflexive feedback loops have not been rigorously analyzed. And when I originally encountered them and tried to analyze them, I ran into various complications. The feedback loop is supposed to be a two-way connection between the participant's views and the actual course of events. But what about a two-way connection between the participant's views? And what about a solitary individual asking himself who he is and what he stands for, and changing his behavior as a result of his reflections? In trying to resolve these difficulties, I got so lost among the categories I created that one morning I couldn't understand what I had written the night before. That's when I gave up philosophy and devoted my efforts to making money. To avoid that trap, let me propose the following terminology. Let's distinguish between the objective and subjective aspects of reality. Thinking constitutes the subjective aspect, events the objective. In other words, the subjective aspect covers what takes place in the minds of the participants, the objective aspect denotes what takes place in the in external reality. There's only one external reality, but many different subjective views. Reflexivity can then connect any two or more aspects of reality, setting up two-way feedback loops. Exceptionally, it may even occur within a single aspect of reality, as in the case of a solitary individual reflecting on his own identity. This may be described as self-reflexivity. We may then distinguish between two broad categories: reflexive relationships, which connect the subjective aspects, and reflexive events, which involve the objective aspect as well. Marriage is a reflexive relationship. The crash of 2008 was a reflexive event. When reality has no subjective aspect, there can be no reflexivity. Feedback loops can be either a negative or positive. Negative feedback brings the participants' views and the actual situation closer together. Positive feedback drives them further apart. In other words, negative feedback is self-correcting. It can go on forever if there are no significant changes in external reality. It may eventually lead to an equilibrium where the participants' views come to correspond to the actual state of affairs. That is what's supposed to happen in financial markets. So equilibrium, which is the central case in economics, turns out to be a limiting case in my conceptual framework. By contrast, a positive feedback process is self-reinforcing. It can't go on forever because eventually the participants' views would become so far removed from objective reality that the participants would have to recognize them as unrealistic. Nor can the iterative process occur without any change in the actual state of affairs, because it's in the nature of positive feedback that it reinforces whatever tendency prevails in the real world. Instead of equilibrium, we are faced with a dynamic disequilibrium, or what may be described as far from equilibrium conditions. Usually, in far from equilibrium situations, the divergence between perceptions and reality leads to a climax, which sets in motion a positive feedback process in the opposite direction. Such initially self-reinforcing, but eventually self-defeating boom-bust processes or bubbles are characteristic of financial markets. But they can also be observed in other spheres. There, I call them fertile fallacies, interpretations of reality that are distorted, yet produce results which reinforce the distortion. I realize that this is all very abstract and difficult to follow. It would make it much easier if I gave some concrete examples. But you'll have to bear with me. I want to make a different point. And the fact that it's so difficult to follow abstract arguments helps me to make it. In dealing with subjects like reality or thinking or the relationship between thinking and reality, it's easy to get confused and formulate problems the wrong way. So, misinterpretations and misconceptions can play a very important role in human affairs. The recent financial crisis can be attributed to a mistaken interpretation of how financial markets work. I shall discuss that in the next lecture. In the third lecture, I shall discuss two fertile fallacies, the Enlightenment fallacy and the postmodern fallacy. These concrete examples will demonstrate how important misconceptions have been in the course of history. But for the rest of this lecture, I shall stay at the lofty heights of abstraction. I contend that situations that have thinking participants have a different structure from natural phenomena. The difference lies in the role of thinking. In a natural phenomena, thinking plays no causal role and serves only a cognitive function. In human affairs, thinking is part of the subject matter and serves both a cognitive and a manipulative function. The two functions can interfere with each other. The interference doesn't occur all the time. In everyday activities like driving a car or painting a house, the two functions actually complement each other. But when it occurs, it introduces an element of uncertainty which is absent from natural phenomena. The uncertainty manifests itself in both functions. The participants act on the basis of imperfect understanding, and the results of their actions will not correspond to their expectations. I call that the human uncertainty principle, and I consider it a key feature of human affairs. By contrast, in the case of natural phenomena, events unfold irrespective of the views held by the observers. The outside observer is engaged only in the cognitive function, and the phenomena provide a reliable criterion by which the truth of the observer's theories can be judged. So the outside observer can obtain knowledge. Based on that knowledge, nature can be successfully manipulated. There is a natural separation between the cognitive and manipulative function, and due to that separation, both functions can serve their purpose better than in the human sphere. At this point, I need to emphasize that reflexivity is not the only source of uncertainty in human affairs. Yes, reflexivity does introduce an element of uncertainty, both into the participants' views and the actual course of events, but other factors may also have the same effect. For instance, the fact that participants can't know what the other participants know is something quite different from reflexivity, yet it's a source of uncertainty. The fact that different participants have different interests, some of which may be in conflict with each other, is another source of uncertainty. Moreover, each individual participant may be guided by a multiplicity of values which may not be self-consistent, as Isaiah Berlin has pointed out. The uncertainties created by these factors are likely to be even more extensive than those generated by reflexivity. I have lumped them all together, and when I speak of the human uncertainty principle, which is an even broader concept than reflexivity. The human uncertainty principle I am talking about is much more specific and stringent than the subjective skepticism that pervades Cartesian philosophy. It gives an objective reason to believe that our perceptions and expectations are, or at least may be, wrong. Although the primary impact of human uncertainty falls on the participants, it has far-reaching implications for the social sciences. I can explicate them best by invoking Karl Popper's theory of scientific method. It's a beautifully simple and elegant scheme. It consists of three elements and three operations. The three elements are scientific laws, and the initial and final conditions to which those laws apply. The three operations are prediction, explanation, and testing. When the scientific laws are combined with the initial conditions, they provide predictions. When they are combined with the final conditions, they provide explanations. In this sense, predictions and explanations are symmetrical and reversible. That leaves testing, where predictions derived from scientific laws are compared with the actual results. According to Popper, scientific laws are hypothetical in character. They can't be verified, they can only be falsified by testing. The key to the success of scientific method is that it can test generalizations of universal validity with the help of singular observations. One failed test is sufficient to falsify a theory, but no amount of confirming instances is sufficient to verify. This is a brilliant solution to the otherwise intractable problem: how can science be both empirical and rational? According to Popper, it's empirical because we test our theories by observing whether the predictions we derive from them are true. And it's rational because we use deductive logic in doing so. Popper dispenses with inductive logic and relies instead on testing. Generalizations that can't be tested do not qualify as scientific. Popper's emphasis on the central role of testing plays a very important role in scientific method and establishes a strong case for critical thinking by asserting that scientific laws are only provisionally valid and remain open to re-examination. Thus, the three salient features of Popper's scheme are the symmetry between prediction and explanation, the asymmetry between verification and falsification, and the central role of testing. Testing allows science to grow, improve, and innovate. Popper's scheme works well for the study of natural phenomena, but the human uncertainty principle throws a monkey wrench into the supreme simplicity and elegance of Popper's scheme. The symmetry between predictions and explanations is destroyed because of the element of uncertainty in predictions. And the central role of testing is endangered. Should the initial and final conditions include or exclude the participants' thinking? The question is important because testing requires replicating those conditions. If the participants' thinking is included, it's difficult to observe what the initial and final conditions are because the participants' views can only be inferred from their statements or actions. If it's excluded, the initial and final conclusions don't constitute singular observations because the same objective conditions may be associated with very different views held by the participants. In either case, generalizations can't be properly tested. These difficulties don't preclude social scientists from producing worthwhile generalizations, but they are unlikely to meet the requirements of Popper's scheme, nor can they match the predictive power of the laws of physics. Social scientists have found this conclusion hard to accept. Economists in particular suffer from what Sigmund Freud might call physics envy. And there have been many attempts to eliminate the difficulties connected with the human uncertainty principle by inventing or postulating some kind of fixed relationship between the participant's thinking and the actual state of affairs. Karl Marx asserted that the ideological superstructure was determined by the material conditions of production. And Freud maintained that people's behavior was determined by drives and complexes of which they were not even aware. Both gained scientific status for their theories, although, as Popper pointed out, they can't be falsified by testing. But by far the most impressive attempt has been mounted by economic theory. It started out by assuming perfect knowledge. And when that assumption turned out to be unsustainable, it went through an increasing contortions to maintain the fiction of rational behavior. Economics ended up with the theory of rational expectations, which maintains that there is a single optimum view of the future, that which corresponds to it, and eventually all the market participants will converge around that view. This postulate is absurd, but it is needed in order to allow economic theory to model itself on Newtonian physics. Interestingly, both Karl Popper and Friedrich Hayek recognized in their famous exchange in the pages of Economica that the social sciences can't produce results comparable to physics. Hayek inveighed against the mechanical and uncritical application of the quantitative methods of natural science. He called it scientism. And Karl Popper wrote about the poverty of historicism, where he argued that history is not determined by universally valid scientific laws. Nevertheless, Popper proclaimed what he called the doctrine of the unity of method, by which he meant that both natural and social sciences should be judged by the same criteria. And Hayek, of course, became the apostle of the Chicago School of Economics, where market fundamentalism was born. But as I see it, the implication of the human uncertainty principle is that the subject matter of the natural and social sciences is fundamentally different. Therefore, they need to develop different methods and they have to be held to different standards. Economic theory should not be expected to produce universally valid laws that can be used reversibly to explain and predict historic events. I contend that the slavish imitation of natural science inevitably leads to the distortion of human and social phenomena. What is attainable in social science falls short of what is attainable in physics. I am somewhat troubled, however, about drawing a sharp distinction between the naturals and social sciences. Such dichotomies are usually not found in reality. They are introduced by us in our efforts to make some sense out of an otherwise confusing reality. Indeed, while a sharp distinction between physics and social sciences seems justified, there are other sciences, such as biology and the study of animal societies, that occupy intermediate position. But I had to abandon my reservations and recognize a dichotomy because the social sciences encounter a second difficulty from which the natural sciences are exempt. And that is that social theories are reflexive. Heisenberg's discovery of the uncertainty principle didn't alter the behavior of quantum particles one iota. But social theories, whether Marxism, market fundamentalism, or the theory of reflexivity, can affect the subject matter to which it refers. Scientific method is supposed to be devoted to the pursuit of truth. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle does not interfere with that postulate, but the reflexivity of social theories does. Why should social science confine itself to passively studying social phenomena when it can be used to actively change the state of affairs? As I remarked in The Alchemy of Finance, the alchemists made a mistake in trying to change the nature of base metals by incantation. Instead, they should have focused their attention on the financial markets, where they could have succeeded. How could social science be protected against this interference? I propose a simple remedy. Recognize a dichotomy between the natural and social sciences. This will ensure that social theories will be judged on their merits and not by a false analogy with natural science. I propose this as a convention for the protection of scientific method, not as a demotion or devaluation of social science. The convention sets no limits on what social science may be able to accomplish. On the contrary, by liberating social science from the slavish imitation of natural science and protecting it from being judged by the wrong standards, it should open up new vistas. It's in this spirit that I shall put forward my interpretation of financial markets tomorrow. I apologize for dwelling so long in the rarefied realm of abstractions. I promise to come down to earth in my next lecture tomorrow. Thank you.
A few weeks ago, Mr. Soros asked me as a preparation for this, the job I'm doing at the moment, to research the intellectual antecedents, if any, of the notion of reflexivity, which he has thought about for so many years and is explaining to you today. So I said, okay, I can do that. So my first recourse was to go to Wikipedia, the well-known resource, and I typed in self-fulfilling prophecy first, and the page came up and I started to read it, and the first thing that's noted in the in that entry was that a man called Robert K. Merton, a sociologist, invented the phrase self-fulfilling prophecy, which apparently derives from the Thomas theorem, which states that, quote, if men define situations as real, they are real in their consequences. So, reading through this entry, first of all, I came across a quote from Robert Merton himself, and he was discussing the case of a bank run caused by a crisis of confidence in the solvency of the bank. So Merton concludes the example by saying, quote, the parable tells us that public definitions of a situation, prophecies or predictions, become an integral part of the situation and thus affect subsequent developments. This is peculiar to human affairs. It is not found in the world of nature, untouched by human hands. Predictions of the return of Halley's Comet do not influence its orbit. But the rumored insolvency of Millingville's bank did affect the actual outcome. The prophecy of collapse led to its own fulfillment. So that's Merton's explanation of his concept of a self-fulfilling prophecy. As I read through, very soon we have a quote preceded by philosopher Karl Popper called the self-fulfilling prophecy the Oedipus effect. This is a quote from Popper's autobiography, Unending Quest. He says, one of the ideas I discussed in the poverty of historicism was the influence of a prediction upon the event predicted. I'd called this the Oedipus effect because the oracle played a most important role in the sequence of events which led to the fulfillment of its prophecy. For a time, I thought that the existence of the Oedipus effect distinguished the social from the natural sciences. That's to say, the influence of a prediction upon the event predicted. But in biology too, he goes on, even in molecular biology, expectations often play a role in bringing about what has been expected. He doesn't actually explain why he thinks that in molecular biology, and on the face of it, it sounds implausible. In any case, that's what he says. So having read Wikipedia, then I had a look at the poverty of historicism. I obtained the book and looked up the Oedipus effect in the index. So I'm going to read you a few passages from the crucial four or five pages so you all have an idea. The point is so as to lay Mr. Soros's idea of reflexivity out in somebody else's words, and then I'm going to invite him to comment on how he sees the notion which he's developed in relation to these earlier ideas of what sound to be similar ideas. And I must say, I was quite struck by Popper's formulation of the idea. So here's what Popper says in The Poverty of Historicism, which I think came out sometime in the 1940s, so quite a long time ago, and Robert Merton was writing around the same time. So page 11, under the heading Inexactitude of Prediction. The idea that a prediction may have influence upon the predicted event is a very old one. Oedipus in the legend killed his father, whom he had never seen before, and this was the direct result of the prophecy which had caused his father to abandon him. This is why I suggest the name Oedipus effect for the influence of the prediction upon the predicted event, or more generally, for the influence of an item of information upon the situation to which the information refers, whether this influence tends to bring about the predicted event or whether it tends to prevent it. He calls it the Oedipus effect. I think it might be more aptly called the Macbeth effect because, of course, as you remember in that play, the witch's prediction of Macbeth's murder of the king is partly, at least, what brings about the murder of the king and many other things that happen in that story. So we have a case of the prediction influencing the course of events. So that's the first formulation. A little bit further, on page 12, he says, it's under the heading Objectivity and Valuation. We are faced in the social sciences with a full and complicated interaction between observer and observed, between subject and object. The awareness of the existence of tendencies which might produce a future event, and furthermore, the awareness that the prediction might itself exert an influence on events predicted, is likely to have repercussions on the content of the prediction. And the repercussions might be of such a kind as gravely to impair the objectivity of the predictions and of other results of research in the social sciences. A prediction is a social happening which may interact with other social happenings, and among them with the one which it predicts. It may, as we have seen, help to precipitate this event, but it's easy to see that it may also influence it in other ways. It may, in an extreme case, even cause the happening it predicts. The happening might not have occurred at all if it had not been predicted. At the other extreme, the prediction of an impending event may lead to its prevention, so that by deliberately or negligently abstaining from predicting it, the social scientist, it may be said, could bring it about or could cause it to happen. There will clearly be many intermediate cases between these two extremes. The action of predicting something and that of abstaining from prediction might both have all sorts of consequences. A final brief quote. The interaction between pronouncements and social life almost invariably creates situations in which we have not only to consider the truth of such pronouncements, but also their actual influence on future developments. The social scientist may be striving to find the truth, but at the same time, he must always be exerting a definite influence upon society. The very fact that his pronouncements do exert an influence destroys their objectivity. So these ideas certainly sound very much in the same ballpark, as we say, as Mr. Soros's ideas. So the first thing I'll do before we turn to questions from the audience is invite Mr. Soros to comment on this and how he sees the concept of reflexivity that he's explained today in relation to these earlier ideas.
Yes. First of all, I think Popper spoke mainly the reflexivity of social theories, whereas I emphasize the reflexivity of the subject matter. I recognize, of course, also the reflexivity of social theories, but more important is that the participants are engaged in reflexive phenomena. And of course, sociology has recognized reflexivity as a social phenomenon, and Merton was definitely the pathbreaker with the bandwagon effect and the self-fulfilling prophecies. But economics has gone out of its way to eliminate reflexivity from the subject matter, and we have paid a very heavy price, amounting to trillions of dollars for that little mistake. So that's, I would say, is the difference. The other thing that I would point out, that this reflexivity as a phenomenon hasn't been analyzed the way, for instance, self-reference with Bertrand Russell and Frege and so on. And I got onto reflexivity by reading about self-reference and the paradox of the liar. That's what led me on. But then I discovered that it is really a much more pervasive phenomenon. So I would say that's those are the major differences. And I then broke down reflexivity into the cognitive and manipulative functions, and argued that the two functions interfere with each other, creating an element of uncertainty, which is a characteristic of human affairs. Of course, it's not the only one, and when it comes to uncertainty, again, economic theory has gone overboard trying to eliminate uncertainty. But there are, of course, very valuable antecedents. I would quote particularly Knight, Knightian uncertainty, which is basically what I'm harping on also.
I mean, one thing you didn't mention there, but it's worth mentioning, I think, is neither Popper nor Merton saw the application of reflexivity to the behavior of financial markets. And since you were a participant in financial markets, you applied it to that area, yes. And where it, of course, applies particularly spectacularly well
right.
in that area, which enabled you to understand
notions. And a particular irony is that Robert Merton's son got a Nobel Prize for devising a formula which ignored reflexivity.
Okay, I'm now, my job is to throw the floor open to our audience, and we're supposed to take questions first from the remote audience at the London School of Economics. We're supposed to take three questions from them before we move to people here. And let me say before getting questions from the LSE that I would implore questioners to, first of all, identify themselves by name and affiliation, then to make their questions concise and to speak as clearly as possible, because we're hearing from here, and to make their questions, not speeches. So a question to Mr. Soros, concisely stated and clearly articulated, would be greatly appreciated. With that, I open the floor to LSE. Now we wait for the moderator in London to
Hello from London. Hello, can you hear us? Or
yes.
See us? Hello, George. We've very much enjoyed your lecture. And we have actually three, I hope four questions, if we can fit it in 10 minutes. I'm going to hand it over to the first person.
Hello, my name is Zachary Mizell.
We need more volume.
I'm a master's student in international political economy here at the LSE. I was interested in how a third party could become aware of a reflexive relationship and how they could sort of interact in order to gain from the information they learn about the existence of that relationship. And an applied example of that would, or applied question would be, how would a government become aware of a positive reflexive relationship and intervene in financial markets in order to dampen the boom-bust cycle that results as a consequence of reflexivity?
Okay. I have unfortunately, difficulty hearing.
I do, too.
Mary, perhaps you could just repeat the question because I have difficulty hearing it.
I couldn't hear it.
Yeah. Could you repeat the question?
What he was
very
interested
briefly.
In was the role of a third party in a reflexive relationship, and in particular, the role of a government. Could the government identify a reflexive participation, a reflexive relationship, in fact, be reflexive itself, in order to dampen down boom-bust cycles? Did you hear that?
Can you?
Can you hear me?
Only just, not enough.
I'm making it simpler and simpler. He put it very well. How can a third party influence a two-party reflexive relationship? And how can a government intervene using your theory to stop a boom-bust cycle? Did you hear that?
How can the government intervene? Well, of course, this question leads up to tomorrow's lecture. That's exactly what I will discuss tomorrow. But let me just preface it, perhaps, by saying that regulators and government and financial authorities also are subject to the same limits of fallibility as market participants. So you have a constant interplay between regulators and market participants, but both sides operate with imperfect understanding. And that's what makes the process so interesting. But I will deal with that more tomorrow.
Unfortunately, we're not going to hear you tomorrow, but perhaps you can tell us when you next come to LSE. I'm handing over to the next question.
Hi, thank you for sharing your insights today. My name is Jawad Karadia, and I am a part-time finance student, master's, and a full-time proprietary trader. And my question to you is if you could talk a little bit about how your general theory relates to trend following and charting in general, and how much you may have or may not have used these sorts of strategies in your own trading. Thank you.
Well, again, obviously, being at the London School of Economics, we are particularly interested in financial markets. And that's again trend following. I could answer in general terms that actually trends tend to validate themselves for an extended period, and therefore trend following is very often a valid strategy which contradicts, let's say, the prevailing paradigm of efficient market and rational expectations. However, reality may not fulfill the expectations that are involved in that trend, and then you reach a point where the trend is reversed, and you don't want to be a trend follower at that time.
Third question.
Hi, I'm Purna Hajani, and I'm an undergraduate student studying social policy. My question to you is, how do you feel about the fact that Adam Smith is known to be the father of economics for his theories on the invisible hand, when market fundamentalism is an economic policy you criticize the most? Thank you.
Again, I didn't understand the question. Did you?
I think the question was, how do you feel about Adam Smith as the father of economics and the inventor of the invisible hand in light of your theory of reflexivity?
Well, you know, Adam Smith wrote two books. I haven't read either of them. And I am critical of the invisible hand, actually. Markets actually perform a very valuable function, but they only are designed to allow individuals to fulfill their individual needs. And there are social issues, like, for instance, the regulation of markets, that markets are not designed to solve or to deal with. So behind the invisible hand of the market, there is hidden the visible hand of politics. And that visible hand is deliberately obscured by market fundamentalists who extol the virtues of the markets, forgetting or obfuscating the fact that behind the market mechanism there are political decisions that are then determining how markets function. I will, again, you are anticipating, actually, this happens to be the fourth lecture, where I will talk about market values and social values and the conflict between capitalism and open society. But I'm happy to anticipate that subject.
I'm surprised that nobody from the LSE wants to ask a question of Mr. Soros about Popper's philosophy versus his philosophy, because after all, this is where Karl Popper was a professor, but there are no questions about the philosophical content of what Mr. Soros said in relation to Popper. But maybe later we can come back to LSE, but I think now we'll throw the questions open to the audience present before us. So anybody with hands up, and then we proceed. Yes. I think you need to get a microphone from somebody, unless, I don't know, unless you can speak loudly.
I would like to know, what's the effect, the role of an educated society as in the reflexivity effect? For one side, a high educated society, each person has a bigger effect. But another side, an educated society is more rational, and perhaps a more rational society, the reflexivity effect is more. Anyway, what's the role of education of a society to have a bigger or a smaller effect?
Well, Christopher Buarque is from Brazil, and he was Minister of Education, and he introduced Bolsa Escola, which is actually a payment to poor families to allow their children to attend school. And I think it's a wonderful scheme and has made a big difference in Brazil, and it has been imitated in other countries, notably Mexico. And I'm actually a great supporter of that scheme. We introduced a variant of it in New York, about which I am not so entirely happy, but I'm supporting it also. And obviously, education is most important for an open society, and the altogether, I think that if people, citizens, would understand the limitations of our ability to deal with social problems, if they understood reflexivity, actually we could deal with our social problems better. So most of my philosophy has a kind of a negative tinge or to it, namely imperfect understanding and fallibility. These all sound very bad, but in effect, if you understand it, and you are in a better position to improve your policies. Perfection can be the bane of social reform. In the French Revolution, people believing in reason engaged in terror. The various ideologies which claim to be in possession of the ultimate truth could be only imposed by force. So I think if we understand our limitations and we turn it around and what is imperfect can be improved. So we are in a way fortunate that with our fallibility, because that leaves infinite scope for improvement. We won't solve all our problems. We leave some for the next generations to come.
So education should teach uncertainty rather than dogma.
Right. And I've been arguing also that we ought to pass from the age of reason to the age of fallibility, that it's an achievement of reason to understand fallibility.
Okay, who's next? Yes, gentleman in the middle there. Better wait for it, yeah.
Thank you. Hello, I'm Roberto Rogel from Mexico. I studied MBA in the CU Business School. My question is, it's been said that the 20th century was the physics century, and this century will be the biology century.
Will be?
The biology.
Biology?
Century. Biology. And there is a hypothesis that telling us that all the sciences will come closer together. Do you think this threatens your own hypothesis or your own proposal that we should separate the social sciences from the natural sciences?
That it doesn't.
Well, I think his question is, if you didn't say much about biology, you did allude to it at one point, mm-hmm. because you have the separation between the social sciences and the natural sciences. He's bringing up the point that biology is becoming central. And so he's wondering whether biology threatens the dichotomy that you have, because it seems to involve, say, study of the social insects, for example.
Right, right.
That kind of issue. I think that's what he's...
Yeah. No, actually, one of the questions that I struggle with is how does reflexivity relate to complexity? Because, let's say, evolutionary systems theory has great similarities with reflexivity in the sense that it does not have a determinate outcome and it evolves. And I think that the two are in a way quite close to each other, in the sense that systems, evolutionary systems theory, network theory, has relevance to human society, which is also a kind of network. So, let's say general rules about network theory apply to actually to financial markets, to banks, because banks were networks, and you had contagion destroying the financial system, similar to a viral attack. So, let's say epidemiology has a relevance, and which we ignored, and which people are now aware of, and we are now looking at those issues. So there are things to be learned from biology and other networks. However, I think reflexivity, which has to do with the specific relationship between thinking and reality, that's a specifically human characteristic. In other words, it applies to human societies. It may apply to whales, because whales seem to be able to communicate, and there are some evidence that actually pretty elaborate societies. I don't want to delimit it purely to human society. But even there, we probably is more more relevant. The content of our thinking is probably more relevant to our problems than the thinking of whales is to our problems. So that's why I think reflexivity throws light on the human condition. And that's how I see the two relate to each other.
And presumably our primate ancestors will have reflexive relations, won't they? One of them thinks another is about to take over their place as the alpha
look,
male.
Look, if I described marriage as a reflexive relationship, then certainly monkeys would qualify for it.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much. My name is Fernando Schmidt. I am the ambassador of Chile. I see a lot of South American people here. Well, my question is very simple. Can you elaborate a little bit more on reflexivity and emotions?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, first of all, reason and emotion are inescapably connected. That's one of the discoveries of brain science, which confirms Hume's contention. So this concept of the disembodied intellect was I think it's currently superseded. But it isn't purely emotion that kind of interferes with reason. There are rational problems in reflexive situations. So, for instance, because of this false dichotomy between reason and emotion and this concept of disembodied intellect and rational behavior, Alan Greenspan described bubbles, IT bubble, technology bubble, as irrational exuberance, these famous words that he applied in 1996. Well, it misdescribes bubbles, because if I, as a market participant, see a bubble coming, I buy, because that's the profitable thing, the rational thing to do. And that creates bubbles. So you can't rely on markets to prevent asset bubbles from forming. And therefore, he was wrong to describe it as irrational. And in effect, you can't account on rational behavior preventing bubbles. So that's a problem that needs to be solved and actually requires the regulators to accept responsibility for preventing asset bubbles from growing too large. So a misinterpretation of what bubbles are or how financial markets operate lead to the wrong policies.
So emotions may be involved in reflexive situations,
yeah, but it's not necessarily. It's not emotion. It's not because it's fear and greed. Right. It's in the nature, right. As I will try to explain tomorrow why and how. It is in the nature of financial markets that they are bubble prone, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not equilibrium bound.
Okay, who's next? Gentleman in the front row. Oh.
I'm a CU student and I'm interested.
We'll have you next.
What is the secret of your financial success in reflect of your family story? Thank you.
I can't hear
that. I didn't hear that.
Sorry.
Can I repeat?
Would you like to come up and maybe can you...
Say it again.
What is the secret of your financial success in reflect of your family story? Thank you.
I would say that recognizing that I may be wrong. As simple as that.
Shall we move to the gentleman here? Yes.
George Steer.
Delighted to see you here.
Should I conclude from what you said that there are no lessons from history?
Hang on.
I speak into this. Should we conclude that there are no real lessons from history, but only subjective interpretations?
No. I don't know how you reach that conclusion from what I said.
Because it cannot be tested.
I was arguing that the methods of natural science, as described so elegantly by Popper, do not apply to the study of history. It doesn't mean that we cannot study history, that we cannot learn lessons, that we can't make reasonable contingent predictions, but not by the methods which produce timelessly valid, universally valid laws. History is one directional. It's not timeless. It's time bound. And when you start with that, then you need different methods for studying historical processes. And I will argue in subsequent lectures that economic theory as such takes the wrong approach because it looks for these universally valid laws like you have in physics, whereas you really need to study markets in financial markets and financial processes in a context. And you have to recognize that conditions change and actually don't repeat themselves.
Lady in the middle there. I need to go away for the micro.
My name is Kotlin Farkas, and I'm a professor of philosophy here at the Central European University. And my question is related exactly to this last point that you made. As you emphasized that Popper's theory of falsification was an explanation of how science can be both empirical and rational, because we have the universal laws, we create a test situation, and if there is a falsifying instance, we give up the law. And on the basis of what you said, we cannot apply the same apparatus in the social sciences, because we cannot aim to have universal laws. So I was wondering, how do you think we can hold up social sciences to the requirement of being rational and empirical?
You see, I think that social science can produce universally valid laws, but those laws don't determine the course of events. So, for instance, I think I put forward the human uncertainty principle as a universally valid hypothesis. And I believe it is actually universally valid. But by its very nature, it doesn't determine, it cannot determine how markets, what, let's say financial markets or history is going to evolve.
In other words, human behavior is unpredictable, and that's a law.
Yes.
Yes.
But there are actually some, for instance, statistical generalizations. I mean, I will distinguish between near equilibrium conditions and far from equilibrium conditions. And it is in the nature of near equilibrium conditions that you can make statistical generalizations, and you can calculate risk on that basis. However, in far from equilibrium conditions, that particular method is going to land you in difficulties, because those things that apply in near equilibrium don't apply in far from equilibrium conditions. That's another generalization.
Here is the question from this side.
You need the microphone over here.
Yeah. No, that's okay. There's somebody there.
Yeah. Julius Horvath, Economics Department, CEU. First question, Mr. Soros, is your opinion or understanding of popper changing as time goes by? Are you more critical or more supportive now, as you were, let's say, in the 50s, you mentioned during your student years? And second question is that...
Let me answer that, yeah, because I forget. I would say that my opinion of Popper is evolving. I have become more critical of him as time went on, and of course he's not around to defend himself, which is... but also, actually, in preparing these lectures, I went a little too far in criticizing Popper, and then I had to revise it because he actually, for instance, did recognize reflexivity. He only applied it to social sciences, but if pressed, he would certainly agree that it also applies, mm-hmm, even with greater force, to participants. Mm-hmm. But. As you will hear in subsequent lectures, he took it for granted that the purpose of thinking of discourse is to get closer to the truth, and that's a false assumption. It's what I call the Enlightenment fallacy. And I, of course, he was a critic of many of the excessive claims for reason. And nevertheless, he and me too fell into that trap. And it has forced me to modify my concept of open society, which I had adopted from him. Please, the second question.
Oh. We understand that your critical position towards the mainstream
which basically rules maybe from the late 70s or this time period. But the question would be, if it is relevant, which economic school you feel close to? Because there is a huge number of schools, not only what you call, this fundamentalist, market fundamentalism. You feel closer to Schumpeter, Hayek, Keynes, Frank Knight you mentioned. Thank you.
No, I was definitely very much influenced by Keynes. And I think that, of course, he lived at a particular moment in history where he had to deal with the incipient or with the problems of depression, and therefore he neglected the problems of inflation. But had he lived at a different time, I'm sure that he would have been also, his analysis would have extended also to analysis of inflation. Because of that, he became discredited in the 70s when inflation was the dominant problem of the time. So I would say that I would consider myself a follower of Keynes. In the same way as I'm a follower of Popper, without necessarily agreeing with everything they said.
Let me add to what you were saying in reply to the first question there. Of course, Popper's name for reflexivity, the Oedipus effect, already tells you he would have agreed that it can occur between individuals, because that was one prediction about a particular man's future action. It wasn't a social science theory influencing thing. So he obviously would have agreed with the general notion, I think, that you were discussing. He doesn't. If he was going to give a name to it, I think he would have called it interactivity, not reflexivity. I think an element that you've emphasized that he doesn't emphasize is the positive feedback aspect. He doesn't ever make the point there that I make the prediction of the event, I change the event that I predict, and then that must change the way I see the world. He doesn't see that circular causation that you emphasize. That's the thing. He doesn't pick up, I think, on that point.
Yeah.
Who's next? I can't see everybody so clearly.
Here,
so.
Here.
Yes, you first. Yes. Microphone's coming from there.
I'm Roman Friedman, professor of economics at New York University. I have a couple of questions. I'll limit myself to two. The first one is that I think what gives reflex, I just wanted to comment on it. You emphasize reflexivity, and there's a certain tension in your writing and even in this speech about the status of fallibility. I wanted to ask you whether fallibility in your mind is necessary for reflexivity to have the force.
Fallibility.
Fallibility being absolutely central. And I wanted to, I can't, there's a, the chairman, so to speak, had clearly indicated no speeches, I will give no speech. I just want to signal what I mean is that if there was a mechanical connection between reality and thinking and back to reality that's reflexive, that certainly would not be something that would yield to the kind of conclusions that you draw in the real world context. And that's where reflexivity is actually quite different from Popper, from Merton. It's very different than the self-fulfilling prophecy that has a vague notion but does suggest such a mechanical connection. So that's the first point I want to give you a comment on. The second question that is directly in my mind related to this, which was asked actually a phenomenal question about educational reflexivity by the gentleman from Brazil, because that question suggests One wonders whether it is complexity that underpins reflexivity. My conjecture here, I have some thoughts on that, is that it is exactly the way Colin just said at the very end, it is change. And it's actually a non-routine change that is crucial for reflexivity to have this force. And you can, yes, when you have education, as Keynes said, we can do more in understanding things, but at some point we're going to reach the limit for it, because there is a question of non-routine change that will always prevent a complete understanding. And therefore, reflexivity is a property of social systems to me, and fallibility, that are properties in principle. These are not properties that could be eliminated with time. They can only be eliminated if change in the world ceases, which of course you have understood in your understanding of the social systems, closed versus open. That's why reflexivity to me, so that this is basically a set of issues, is reflexivity really related to complexity rather than change and things that relate around this?
Yeah. First of all, of course, fallibility is absolutely essential. It's a universal human condition. And the reflexivity is a two-way connection between biased or misconceptions and, let's say, the objective reality. And there are ways in which misconceptions can actually change the objective conditions. That's reflexivity. But in order to have reflexivity, you must have the misconceptions or the bias view to start with. Otherwise, you wouldn't have the two-way connection. So it replaces this strange concoction of perfect knowledge that is characteristic of the prevailing dogma in economics. So that's...
You didn't say anything about the relation between reflexivity and complexity,
yeah,
which Roman was asking about.
Well, you see, this is an issue that, as I say, I only have a tentative answer at the moment. Actually, reflexivity doesn't need to be complex, you see. And therefore, you can't say that it's the same thing. Because actually, reflexivity can be something very, very simple, like an enmity between people where one person says to the other, "You are my enemy," and lo and behold, he is your enemy. That's not complex.
I think what underlies reflexivity is awareness, that I can be aware of your attitudes towards me, and that can change myself. Yes. But of course, when you're looking at the natural world, it's not aware of your attitudes or predictions about it, Halley's Comet or the motions of the planets. So they can't be influenced by our beliefs about them. But as humans, we can be aware of other people's beliefs about us as they express them in statements, and then that can change us as a result of it. I think so that, I think, is what reflexivity comes from. Yes. Consciousness, awareness of others.
Yes. And there's one other point with regard to education. You see, while education is a wonderful thing, it doesn't necessarily give you very good results, because reality can be manipulated. And if you're good at manipulating reality, you can get better results. But how you manipulate, what your objectives are, depend on your values. And values are particularly, how shall I say, questionable. In other words, there is no one set of values that you can say, that's good. So we have done a lot as a foundation in the way of education. And sometimes we have educated very clever manipulators of public opinion who then used it for very different purposes for which I would have liked them to use it.
There was a lady in the third row there, yes.
As Margaret de Heinrich. And the one word that keeps popping up in my mind from the very beginning of your talk is instinct. And Professor, it's what you were talking about, alluding to awareness, and of course that's the same thing. And you're someone, Mr. Soros, who's been enormously successful. And I imagine in some part because of your natural instinct. And the question is, if your sharing the concept of reflexivity with so many people, if they don't possess that natural God-given gift of instinct, how can they truly take reflexivity and use it to its full power?
I don't get the question. Do you?
Well, I think the question is you have this conceptual idea of reflexivity which you've applied in your business life, and could other people have had the same success just by taking over the idea, or was it more to do with other factors about you than just having that theory? Yeah. I think that was the form of the question.
Is that your question? Well,
we all have the theory now. We're not all successful.
Yeah. Well, look, it's obviously it's not sufficient. I mean, it's been useful, but it didn't determine the outcome. But the fact is that at the time when I first started using those ideas, they did give me a leg up in the financial markets, because people were, most other players in the market were guided by other ideas. Mm. So, however, people did read my book, so I've lost that edge that I had.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, it enables you to predict bubbles more easily. Well, it enables you to predict bubbles more easily.
Well, you know, there's a saying that economists have predicted 8 of the last 3 recessions. Well, I predicted 8 of the next 3 bubbles.
What about Howard Robinson in there in the front? He needs a microphone, I think. Is there a microphone nearby? Yeah, okay. This would be a philosophical question, I'm sure.
I was going to say,
this will be
a straight philosophical question, I'm afraid. What do you think the connection of your doctrine of reflexivity is to this old-fashioned chestnut of free will? Does it follow from what you said that there could not be a deterministic account of human behavior, because in some sense or other there are no definite facts about human psychology or what people are going to do? These are not the kind of things that can be put into natural laws, and therefore determinism must be false and good old libertarian free will must be right. Or don't you want to go down that road?
Well, we had a very interesting discussion last night about determinism and free will, and I would take the position that both are half right. And if you put them together, you actually get the reality. To think of free will as being absolutely free is, to me, even more distorted than to claim that human affairs are determined by universally valid laws. I mean, there are, of course, not all of reality can be manipulated. The laws of physics that prevail. So you may be extremely good at turning reality, manipulating reality, but in the end, reality has the last word, and you're going to be dead. Now, that's something, for instance, you cannot manipulate away, even though we have developed all kinds of myths to deal with this rather unpalatable prospect.
Well, there are no deterministic laws of psychology itself, as opposed to...
Well, I would say that Freud identified maybe certain people who are sick in the sense that their actions are determined by their idée fixe, preconceived ideas. But a well-functioning human being has to be influenced by reality.
Yes, I mean, I think your position is that the world is half determined and the will is half free. The world is half determined and the human will is half free.
Well, okay.
As you said, it was half. Each of them was half true. Who's next? Something more philosophical would be welcome if there was something. Let's go to the back.
All right, there.
You want to go back then, George? Okay. No, he's got the microphone over there. So.
Microphone?
He's got the microphone there.
Hello. Thank you. I am Rodrigo from Mexico. I am a student of public policy at CU. And first, just to say that I'm very grateful. It's been a very enriching experience being in this university, in this environment. And I would like to ask you, Plato, another philosopher, had a negative vision of time or an idea that time had a degenerative effect over things, over reality. On the other hand, the paradigm of modernity presents more of a faith in progress, a conviction that the future will be better than the present. What do you think? Is this a Byzantine discussion, a pointless discussion, or you have a standing point? What's the time, what's the effect of time over things from your perspective? Thank you.
You know, I'm sorry about not fully understanding the question.
Should I repeat it very briefly?
My attitude to Plato has been greatly influenced by Karl Popper, although perhaps he has been a little too harsh on Plato.
I think he's asking about progress, whether you believe in progress.
Progress.
I think so.
What do you think?
Yes, certainly I do believe in progress. I definitely think that we can improve our understanding. And certainly I would argue that, let's say, understanding reflexivity makes dealing with human problems, political problems, much more difficult. And some of our preconceived ideas have to go out of the window. But it is progress, because I think we then understand the difficulties involved in human affairs. And usually misconceptions get particularly wild and far-fetched when you are confronted with insoluble problems. We don't like to tolerate insoluble problems, and therefore we tend to devise false solutions. Again, I come back to death, which is an insoluble problem in the sense it's most likely to occur. And we have then developed all kinds of ways of and myths to do away with it, that prospect. And there are many other, to go from the sublime to the ridiculous, the drug problem. It's an insoluble problem. Drug addiction is innate in human nature. Some people get addicted, and it is a threat to society, and society then deals with it, and the way it deals with it, it makes it a much worse problem than the drug addiction itself. And the way, for instance, American society has dealt with death has made dying much harder and much more painful, not to mention more expensive, than it need to be. And actually, the two first projects of my foundation in America, one was the project on death in America, and the other one was the drug policy initiative. And I arrived at it from this rather abstract philosophical argument about insoluble problems, creating remedies which make the problems worse. Mm. Does that answer anywhere near your question?
It enlightens me in other issues. Basically, I wanted to ask you, what do you think? Time goes by, right? And time has any kind of effect over things, over a political regime. Plato would say that time has a negative effect, and the effect of time over things turn it degenerative. As opposed to that conception, modernity says that the effect of time over things is positive and says that future will be better, no? As against to the conception of Plato. What do you think? What's the effect of time, if any, at all? Or okay. It's maybe a bit...
I have to interrupt because we're supposed to wind up at this point. I'm told that it's the end of the time and we should do it.
I know today's wonderful 2 hours has only whetted your appetite for the remainder of the week. This has been an extraordinary moment, and I want to thank our audiences here in Budapest at the Hungarian Academy of Sciences and Central European University, and also in London at the London School of Economics. But of course, above all, to thank George Soros for sharing his thoughts, his experience, his philosophy, and launching us on an extraordinary journey that we'll all be going with him. And also to Colin McGinn, thank you for all you've done to facilitate today. Thank you very much.